All right, let's turn, please, to the book of Isaiah, chapter 36. We're coming to a very critical point in the entire book of Isaiah. By the way, one other thing before we get into our study. We have been having a problem with tapes whereby volume will be fine and it will suddenly drop. And we have tried everything we know to find out what the problem is, and we still don't have it licked. If you have a tape that has that problem, one or two problems, blank on one side, plays fine on the other, or you're going along and suddenly the volume just falls off. If you've got a tape like that, bring it. We need to try to analyze and see if we can find out what is happening. We do not know what the problem is. It seems to be related to all of the machines, so I don't know where we're hurting, but there is a problem, and if you do have a problem on a tape, in fact, anytime you have a problem on a tape, it's let us know, because we want to run those things down. I think we're almost down to the fact that there are little men in Jane's office, and they hide in the high-speed duplicators, and they reach up and they jerk on tapes somewhere in the middle, but we're puzzled, and we want to solve it, and so if you have a tape that has a problem on it, you do us a favor by letting us know that the volume fell off. I think in many cases it's not falling off all the way. It's falling off to the point of you have to reach over and crank up the volume to get it to a listenable area. So if you have a problem like that, please let us know. It'd be of help to us. We're coming to a very critical point in the book of Isaiah in that the book is divided into two parts, and that is chapters 1 through 39, and we're coming right down to that, and then chapters 40 through 66. And in these sections, when we come to chapter 40, and we will probably be there, well, within the next 2 to 4 studies, you have in chapter 40, probably, if you want to talk about the character of God, probably nothing develops it more systematically and definitely than Isaiah chapter 40, because when we talk about the character of God and look at His greatness, His omnipotence, His power, we talk about the fact that God is transcendent. We have a transcendent God. And wrapped up in the word transcendent is the idea of being awesome, of being great, of being mighty. When we talk about His omniscience, the fact that God knows everything past, everything present, everything future, everything possible, we're talking about the transcendency of God. At the same time, the Scripture is very clear that the God who is transcendent is also immanent. And by the word immanent, we simply mean He is personal. And therefore, if I would take a couple of English words to put them with these two ideas, transcendent and immanent, with transcendent, I would use the word awesome. The awesomeness of God. If I would try to find a simple English word to go with the idea that God is immanent, I would use the word personal. And when you come to Isaiah chapter 40, which we will very soon be at, in Isaiah 40 you have a dealing with both of these things. For example, looking at the awesomeness of God, you have a rhetorical question asked in chapter 40, which simply reads in verse 18 by saying, "To whom then will you liken God?" And the following context is developed into showing that He is so transcendently great that there is absolutely no one to whom God can be compared. And it emphasizes His awesomeness. At the same time, if you go down to verse 11, you have a great emphasis, very colorful, very picturesque, on the fact that the God who is awesomely great is also immanent and personal. And you have the words of verse 11 that says, "Like a shepherd, He will tend His flock. In His arm, He will gather the lambs and carry them in His bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewes." So you have an emphasis on how personal God is. And I know of no place in all of the Word of God to go to see these two ideas developed more, so that hopefully when we come to Isaiah chapter 40, we will have a more fully developed idea of who is God? And we'll be able to answer that by saying, He is awesomely great, breathtaking in His greatness, and at the same time, He is very, very personal with those who are His people. And we'll be coming to that very soon in the next three or four studies. Now, however, we are looking at Isaiah 36 through 39. Isaiah 36 through 39. And in looking at those chapters, a couple of things we need to say by way of introduction to them. And the first is, in these chapters, we make a transition. They are transitional chapters. And that is the first point of introduction, is Isaiah 36 through 39 makes a transition. And the transition is a twofold thing. First of all, it is a historical transition in the book of Isaiah. Chapters 36 through 37 are about the invasion of Judah by Assyria. And what happens is this great world power, Assyria, comes down, attacks Judah, and by the end of these chapters, Assyria itself is doomed and it meets its destiny. Chapter 38 and 39 are really about Hezekiah and his illness. If you go over to chapter 39 and verse 1. The historical transition is we go from the threat of the great world kingdom of Assyria over to the rise of the following nation, which is Babylon. And if you look at chapter 39 and verse 1, you have come through that transition, because 39 reads as follows. At that time, Merodach-Baladan. We have lots of young people. Any pregnant ladies here wondering what you're going to call your son? There's a beauty. Call him Merodach-Baladan. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah. So Hezekiah will move all the way from the fall of Assyria as a world power down to Babylon. We have a historical transition that is there, so that if we would look at it in the following way, Isaiah chapter 1 through 35 looks at Assyria as the world power. However, when you come to chapter 40 through chapter 66, you have Babylon as a world power. So that really, behind the book of Isaiah, you've got two great world systems. Assyria in the first half of the book, and you have Babylon in the second part of the book. Historical transition. Second, the 36th through 39th chapter of Isaiah present to us a spiritual transition. And the spiritual transition sees the nation of Judah, first of all, under King Ahaz, and second, under King Hezekiah. Hezekiah and Ahaz are related together as father and son. And the contrast between the two is very simple. Under the threat of Assyria, under the threat of attack, under Ahaz, the nation chooses not to trust God. So under Ahaz, there is no trust. As we have said in the book of Isaiah, the issue is so simple. You may either trust God and rest that the nations will be cared for by Him, or you trust man. Under Ahaz, there is no trust, and under Hezekiah, you have them trusting God. So really, the outcome of both is different also. Under Ahaz, they refuse to trust the Lord, and they are taken captive by their enemies. Under Hezekiah, they choose to trust God, and in trusting God, they have a great delivery. So that is our first point then out of Isaiah 36 through 39, It is a section of transition. Second point of introduction is focusing now down to Isaiah 36. And Isaiah 36 involves 3 points. Number one, you have coming face to face with the nation of Israel, a challenge from Assyria. Challenge of Assyria, chapter 36, verses 1 through 20, and that is about as far as we will get in our study in this hour. The challenge of Assyria. Rabshakeh will come face to face with Hezekiah and say, we are going to give you an ultimatum. It is either surrender to us or we will destroy you. So the challenge comes in 36, 1 through 20, and to that challenge, you have the response of the nation, or the response of Judah, 36, 21 through 37 and verse 35. Very dramatic type thing if you look at chapter 36 and verse 20. You have the challenge and a very dramatic response. Verse 20 says, who among all of the gods of these lands have delivered their land from my hand that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? Response, verse 21. But they were silent and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, do not answer him. So you have a very sharp contrast and a marking off point between the challenge to Judah and the response of Judah. That is then followed by an equally dramatic thing. And if you'll turn to chapter 37 and verse 36, you have very sharply marked off the victory of God. 37, 36 through 38. Verse 36 says, then the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians, and when the men arose early in the morning, behold, all of them, that is the Assyrians, were dead bodies. And so you have again a dramatic mark-off in the section. So in our study today, we are basically going to look at the challenge that Rabshakeh gives to Judah in challenging the authority of their God. So we begin then with our first point, and the thing we'll be looking at today, the challenge 36, 1 through 20. And our first point is to take a look at the setting. The setting for all of this is Isaiah 36, 1 through 3. Setting, Isaiah 36, 1 through 3. And under the setting, we can again break this down into the time that all of this takes place. Verse 1. In those days, Hezekiah became... Pardon me, I'm 38 here, chapter 36. Now, it came about in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. So we know from not only biblical history that dates it in the 14th year of Hezekiah, but from external history, this man, Sennacherib, began his military campaigns in 703 B.C. And in 703 and 702, you had military confrontation. And this was other than Israel and Judah. So you have 2 years whereby and wherein Sennacherib is making conquest and he's moving. And you find that after 2 years, in 701 B.C., he confronts Judah. So we have a passage in the book of Isaiah that we can date and we're looking at the year 701 that he comes into contact with him. That is the time setting. Second, in this confrontation, you have two sets of delegations. And you have the delegation first of Assyria and second of Judah. First of Assyria, chapter 36, now, and verse 2. And the king of Assyria sends Rabshakeh. That probably, in fact, in all probability, is not a name, but an office. And thus, you might have a translation that would read something like, in verse 2, the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh. It was an office, probably not a name, but we will treat it today in terms of though it were a proper noun and call this individual Rabshakeh. Sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem to King Hezekiah with a large army. Now let's see if we can put some names in that, because we have a parallel passage going to 2 Kings 18. 2 Kings 18. Second Kings, chapter 18. This passage is historically parallel to what we have in Isaiah 36, chapter 18 and verse 17. It says, then the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a large army to Jerusalem. So, without rewriting those names, the important thing to note is that the three people that were sent by Sennacherib were his three chief officers, three chief leaders from Assyria. And we should also note that when he sent those three chief leaders, they were high officials, and we add to them plus a large army. Thus, when Sennacherib approaches Judah, he approaches Judah with two things. Number one, with the leader's prestige. Second, with the army, force. Prestige and force. And thus, if we go back to chapter 36 and verse 2, the two points to note is the prestigious individuals that were sent and the show of force that was put in front of Judah. In meeting the challenge of Assyria, you have a second delegation, and it's the delegation of Judah. And that is set in front of us in chapter 36 and verse 3. It says, then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. And the important thing to note is these were non-military personnel. They were simply people out of the royal household that went out to meet these challenge from Syria. Third, we've got the time, the delegations, and now the place. Where do they meet? Chapter 36 and verse 2. And the king of Assyria sends Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem to King Hezekiah with a large army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway of the Fuller's Field. Two things about the place. First of all, if we would go clear back to Isaiah chapter 7, this is the same place, identically, that Ahaz met. And in 2 Kings chapter 7, with the arrival at the same place we have here, we have a contrast. And the place that Ahaz met namely mentioned in chapter 36, is the place where he was challenged by Isaiah to believe God. When we come to chapter 36, his son meets Rabshakeh in the same place, and again he is challenged as to whether he is going to believe God. The important thing about the fact that they met and were challenged at the upper pool is very simple. When Jerusalem was under siege, she was surrounded with walls. And the only way you could survive was obviously by having a water supply. The water supply was outside of the city. And thus, the water supply was the place of security. Now, the way to get the force of that, of what is happening in Isaiah chapter 36, I think, would be this. Down the side of your neck, on both sides, you have two arteries called the what? You got your carotid arteries. And you well know that if they are, someone puts their arm around you and squeezes tight, that you can drop very, very quickly. Picture it this way. Assyria stands at the water gate, and the arm of Assyria is around the neck of Judah on the carotid artery. And so it's the idea that, how do we put it sometimes in English, colloquially, Assyria literally has Judah by the jugular vein, so that it's just a little squeeze and she's going to be dead. And the first 20 chapters will revolve about that, first 20 verses will revolve about that point. So when we come down in chapter 36, clear down through verse 20, just picture in your mind that Assyria has Judah right where all they have to do is pull a little tight and Judah will drop in terms of destruction. And this is the place that she is standing in this particular point. Now, all of this had to add up to a thing that Isaiah does not picture, but 2 Kings has to, is the idea that this had to be an utter surprise on the part of Hezekiah. Something happens here that he just didn't expect. Keeping your finger in Isaiah 36, go back to 2 Kings 18. 2 Kings 18. Isaiah does not record this, but in the historical section of 2 Kings, Hezekiah had good enough sense to look out there and say, Assyria could very well destroy us. It's in our best interest to make peace. And so, in the interest of making peace, notice what he had done. 2 Kings chapter 18, and we're down at verse 13. Now, in the 14th year of Hezekiah, same time frame as in the book of Isaiah, chapter 36, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. That's a very simple deal. Sennacherib, what's it going to take for you to cool it, for you to let me alone? You name the price, I'll pay you if you'll let me alone. And so the latter part of verse 14, so the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. In other words, you can buy me. I will leave you alone if you will pay the price. So, verse 15, Hezekiah gave him all the silver which was found in the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. Very, very interesting how, what do we say in English? When the option is trust God or trust man, it's interesting how Hezekiah initially, in order to protect himself, was willing to eat crow. Can't you see the king down there scraping the gold off of the temple doors? He says, what in the world are you doing that for? To buy security. And it will be very interesting that that will buy nothing, because you come to Isaiah chapter 36, and right on the front doorstep, what does he find? He finds the nation of Assyria challenging the entire nation. And so under the idea of surprise that would be in Isaiah 36, the means of security, or the means of gaining security, have failed. Of course, Hezekiah could come running out and say, hey, we paid you. Aren't you going to keep your deal? There's no way he could shake his fist in the face of Sennacherib. Sennacherib was Sennacherib. He was powerful and he was mighty. And it is so interesting that the things that we so often buy to gain us security turn around and come back on us. And that's exactly what's happening in chapter 36. All right, with that then, as a setting for what we're looking at, let's now look at the challenge. And I really think probably challenge is not the right word. I think I probably ought to be using the word ultimatum, because it's more an idea of either you bow or else. Well, with the challenge, you have this representative of Sennacherib coming along with these arguments. And so let's look at his first argument. He has several points. As a matter of fact, as I counted, he makes 4 basic points. Rabshakeh was not a preacher. Preachers have 3 points. He had 4. And with his 4 points, he comes on to the nation of Judah, and he says, his first argument is this. If you trust Egypt, you trust a broken reed. You trust a crushed reed. Figure of speech. If you trust Egypt, you trust a crushed reed. Isaiah 36, beginning with verse 4. Then Rabshakeh said to them, say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what is this confidence you have? I say, your counsel and strength for the war are only empty words. Now on whom do you rely, that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, even on Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all those who rely on him. So notice the fact, and I think I'm going to alter our word here, away from the idea of challenge to the word ultimatum. And my justification for moving away from challenge to justification, to the idea of more of an ultimatum, is notice 3 emissaries have gone out to address the king. And instead of addressing the representatives, he bypasses them. He bypasses the reps. The second thing that points to this being more of an ultimatum is the fact that Rabshakeh does not refer to Hezekiah as king. So let's just put, he omits king. Very heavy on King Sennacherib. Rabshakeh, verse 4 says, say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what is this confidence you have? In other words, all through the passage, he never refers to Hezekiah as a king. The king is only Sennacherib in the fullest sense of the word. And this is basically the thinking of this man. No diplomacy. He's being very, very crude. Second, not only is this argument an ultimatum, But we also might add that Isaiah agrees with Rabshakeh. If you trust Egypt, you're trusting a broken reed. And Isaiah says, I agree, you're right. That is all that Egypt is. So the same argument is presented by Isaiah that is presented by Rabshakeh. If you're trusting Egypt, you're trusting something that will not support you. Second argument. The second argument is simply going to be this. If you say you trust the Lord, He won't support you either. So the second argument is the Lord, or Yahweh, He will not support you either. You can't trust Egypt, and let me tell you, you cannot trust the Lord. Verse 7. What is that noise? Someone go in the nursery and tell him to put that kid in a bag or something. Thank you, John. You look like you're up to it. Is it your son? Okay. Well, why don't we just be blind? Why don't we get that Balhazen kid and... Okay. Boudiette kid here. Okay, second argument comes now down to verse 7. If you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not He whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away? Now, for this second argument, was that your kid, John? No? Okay. I'll never forget about a year ago saying to somebody, you know, I said, kids, tear down those halls downstairs, and I wonder where their parents are. And the person came back and said, are you aware that when Greg was little, he was probably the worst of the whole lot? And I didn't realize that. Okay, the argument then is that the Lord will not support you. And the important thing to get on verse 7 is to be sure we look at this the way Rabshakeh did. In other words, we need to get a polytheistic viewpoint. A polytheistic viewpoint would say this: the more altars you have, the more you honor God. In other words, the gods are pleased that you've got 24 different places out there that you honor them. And if you move the 24 up to 36, the gods will be all the more pleased because you'll have lots of altars. Now, Hezekiah had started a little campaign. And let's mark Isaiah 36 and go back to 2 Kings 18 once again. And note what Hezekiah had done. 2 Kings 18. Verses 1 through 5. Hezekiah had started an enormous reform. Now, if you're acquainted with the Old Testament, you know that the Old Testament is full of there is only one true God, and He can only be worshipped in one true place. In other words, in Israel, there was a central altar, and that was at Jerusalem. And so in chapter 18, through depravity, the nation had made many, many altars. And when Hezekiah comes along, he institutes a reform, reading about it in chapter 18, verse 1. Now, it came about in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, became king. And he was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places and broke down the sacred pillars, cut down the Asherah. He also broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the sons of Israel burned incense to it, and it was called Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, among all those that were before him. So Hezekiah institutes this great reform, and he tears down all of the altars outside of Jerusalem. Now, look at that from a polytheistic viewpoint. And Rabshakeh is coming along and saying, I'll tell you why God won't support you. You tore down all of the altars to him. You destroyed them. You wiped him off. He is going to be aggravated at you because of the depletion of altars. So let's put the depletion of altars. This is polytheistic viewpoints. The depletion of altars has angered God. Now, with that in mind, and with that viewpoint in mind, let's go back to Isaiah 36 and read the seventh verse. If you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not He whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away? And polytheistic viewpoint is going to say, boy, is he ever going to be mad because you have removed his altars and has said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar. In other words, you have reduced the altars to one, and that is going to anger God, and therefore you cannot trust him. So that really when you put the two arguments together, the first argument, if you trust Egypt, is designed to crush their political hopes. The second argument, if you trust God, is designed to trust their crush their religious or spiritual confidence. And with that, you come on to the third argument. The third argument is in verses 8 and 9. Now, what you want to do beginning with verses 8 and 9 is the arrogance begins to build up. And Rabshakeh is going to say something very simple. Let me trace his argument. You can't trust Egypt because they are politically dead. Isaiah told you that. You can't trust God because you made him mad. Third, you are so weak that if we gave you 2,000 horses, you couldn't beat us if we supply your military support. We are that strong and you are that weak. Question. Is this good or is this bad? Rabshakeh is wearing Judah down to a nub. I mean, the more he talks, the more they realize their impossible situation. We trusted Egypt to be a little help. And they chewed off the number 1, 2, and 3 fingernail with that one. You've made God mad because you've destroyed a lot of altars and reduced it to one. And there went the 4th and 5th fingernail chewed off. And now he comes along and says, would you like for us to supply your army? We'll give you 2,000 horses. Couldn't put 2,000 riders on them, could you? No, they couldn't. And there goes some fingernails on the next hand. Isn't that awful? No. You know what Rabshakeh is doing? He's preparing Judah by showing how weak she is, that Judah will have no recourse except to trust God. And we ought to make a quick application of that. Have you ever sensed that maybe God is wearing you down to a nub? And everything you devise for support turns out to be nothing. And God is saying, hey, that's good, isn't it? Because I'm teaching you, you can't trust anything on the outside. You can only trust me. So really, Rabshakeh, he doesn't know it, naturally. But because God is so enormously sovereign, God is taking Rabshakeh and saying, Rabshakeh, I'm going to use you in your rebellion to prepare my people for my blessing. And therefore, he's wearing the people down, and of course, that is going to be good. So the third argument is simply this. You can't beat us with or without horses. You can't beat Assyria even if we supply the military hardware. And that will be the offer that is made, and I'll put a couple of exclamation points after that. You cannot beat us even if we supply the military hardware. Verse 8. Now therefore, come make a bargain with my master, king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses. And now you've got a picture. Can you picture his face? when he says these last words, if you're able on your part to set riders on them. And he's got to have a wry little smile because he knows they can't. How then can you repulse, verse 9, one official of the least of my master's servants and rely on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? In other words, the third argument is simply saying we are so powerful that there is no way that you can beat us. So, at the end of the third argument, the net result is to teach Israel is we have no resource. We are weak, weak, weak. So Rabshakeh unknowingly prepares Judah for spiritual victory because there is no way that salvation or the Christian life is ever experienced until we realize that we are absolutely, totally, 100% bankrupt. We can do nothing whatsoever to merit salvation. We can do nothing to merit blessing in the Christian life. And therefore, we ought to look at all of those things on the outside that keep underlining, you have no resource. You can't do it. Your plan didn't work. The thing that you thought would support you has failed you. And all of that is God underlining, you have no resource. When will you learn that I alone am all you have and will turn to me? So the principle involved is simply this, that God is able to use our enemies as instruments to prepare us for His blessing. Now, fourth argument. And the fourth argument is a very forceful one, and it's this. You know something? Your own God has sent me against you. Your God is against you. And that's found in verse 10. And have I now come up without the Lord's approval against this land to destroy it? Now that's getting real down home, isn't it? You know, to say that, look, not only can you not trust your God isn't even for you. He's not working on your behalf. He has commissioned me to come up against you to destroy it. And thus, the latter part of verse 20, the Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Notice a couple of things about that verse. Notice, first of all, Rabshakeh claims to have extra revelation. God said to me, and you're supposed to knuckle under when he says that, your God said, go against this land and destroy it. So the emphasis then is God is against you. Now, that may seem unusual to us, but if you read any Near Eastern literature, you know that one of the ways the conquerors will record their victories is to say this. The reason I beat you and destroyed your nation was because your God joined my team. And having joined my team, your God worked against you. So this would not be unusual at all. Now there's another thing also in verse 10 that is a possibility. Had Isaiah said anything about how God was going to judge Judah? Well, you go back in the following context, and God had said that I am going to use Assyria as my instrument to judge you. I wonder if Sennacherib got a hold of that message. You look at verse 10 and you kind of wonder, don't you, that he may have gotten a hold of the message that we're going to be God's instrument to just destroy Judah and could have heard that and is repeating it back to them. You can imagine then at the end of verse 10 that the people would be absolutely reduced to total fear. And in the context of that fear, you now have, following the arguments that present a challenge, you now have, in verse 11, a request. 36:11. The setting has been the three Jewish leaders go out to meet Rabshakeh and are negotiating with him. Well, not negotiating, they're being challenged by him. And what happens, by the time you get to verse 10, things have gotten a little bit loud, and the Jewish delegation says, look, everybody's listening. Hey, we're in a restaurant, and you're talking loud, and everybody is looking. Would you mind to cool it? So notice verse 11. Then Eliakim and Shebna and Joah said to Rabshakeh, speak now to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in Judean, and the hearing of the people are on the wall. Got the picture? It's gotten kind of noisy, and somebody said, hey, what's going on at the edge of the city? And I said, I don't know, let's go down and see. And so people have began to gather around the wall, things get loud, and the three Jewish representatives look around and say, hey, the people are going to hear this and they're going to panic. Would you mind to get quiet? And as soon as he is requested to get quiet, what does he do? Verse 13. Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in Hebrew. And thus we have the setting that leads us into the next section. This is one of the great challenges of Judah to learn to trust God. So they refuse, and if you look at chapter 36, not only does he get loud and vocal, he gets crude. And so you come down to verse 12. Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me only to your master and to speak and to you to speak these words and not to the men who sit on the wall, doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? And that's kind of a climactic point. It's loud, it's crude, and he says, we are going to wipe you out. And the challenge that will come about will come down to verse 15. And it really climaxes Isaiah 7 through 36. We have said in these chapters, the issue is, do you trust God or do you trust man? And the issue comes to a head in verse 15. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord. That is the issue. And that issue will be solved in the context, and we'll come to that in our next study. Father, we're thankful today for your word. We're thankful that forever in life we are facing a challenge. Do we trust you or do we trust man? And the challenge, as Isaiah will enter the picture, the first words that he will speak to Judah in response to the challenge of Rabshakeh are those words that so permeate your scriptures. Thus says the Lord. And they face the issue of, do we trust the Lord and his word, or do we trust man? And we pray that we will learn from this chapter that all things are designed in life to bring us to the end of ourselves and to the beginning of the appreciation of the great God that we know and serve, and in whose name we pray.